there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 355. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. Another jam-packed episode this week with two incredible guests. Let me introduce the first one to you right this very second. Arthur Slepian is the founder and executive director of A Wider Bridge, an organization dedicated to building bridges between Israelis and LGBTQ North Americans and allies. Arthur has decades of experience as a leader in the Jewish community, along with a successful career as a leader in the business world, which we're going to talk all about. He serves on the Board of Trustees of the Jewish Community Federation of the San Francisco Bay Area, the chair of the LGBT Alliance of the Federation, and serves on the San Francisco Area Jewish Community Relations Council. Arthur has been a leader for more than 15 years at Congregation Shahar Zahav in San Francisco, one of the nation's oldest and largest synagogues, serving primarily LGBT Jews, where he has served as president from 2003 to 2006 and continues to serve in a variety of leadership roles. A Wider Bridge recently announced a groundbreaking U.S. tour with leaders of the Ethiopian Israeli LGBTQ community, which we are going to discuss. But first, let's welcome him. Arthur, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thanks, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
We have so much ground to cover, sir. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So I'm looking back at the Arthur background. I'm seeing quite a bit of business here, sir. A master's in economics at Stanford, a bachelor's in economics at Yale. I'm seeing business.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I got to do in my business career was build and start a number of smaller companies as part of some of the financial enterprises that I worked for. And I think I was able to bring a lot of that experience to when it came time for me to start this new nonprofit, A Wider Bridge. You know, my business career was very rewarding to me, but I think in this work where I'm combining, I think, the two things in life that I'm most passionate about, which is my the struggle for LGBT equality and my love for Israel, I'm really doing something that it provides me with great joy, that I have great passion, it brings great meaning and fulfillment to my life, and I'm having more fun than I've had in decades.
I like hearing that. That's a great thing. Was there a pivotal moment? Is there one point that you can point to, one point that you can identify where you say, okay, I'm making this transition, I'm going all in from business into advocacy and activism?
Well, you know, I think one moment was in 2009. There was this awful shooting in Tel Aviv at the youth center for LGBT people there, where some gunmen entered in and they started shooting, and two people were killed and many other people were wounded. And that brought a lot of Israeli LGBT leaders to come to the U.S. to talk about this incident and talk about the work that they do and the support that they need. And the thought that occurred to me was, Why does it take a tragedy for us to be learning about each other and talking about each other's lives? And I had been to Israel. I knew what a remarkable LGBT community they had there. And I just felt there was so much more that we could gain from working with each other, from learning about each other's lives and our struggles, that we could just be so much stronger together if we found ways to be partnering and being in dialogue all the time and not just when there might be some crisis.
Nice. Before we talk specifically about A Wider Bridge, let's step back a bit. Talk to me about your relationship with Israel. Now, I will tell you, I have never been. I am the only one in my family who has never been, but we are all going next December 2017. So the whole family's going to Israel. And all I've been told is you almost just can't prepare yourself for the culture and the beauty that you will encounter. Talk to me about your experience in Israel.
Yeah, you know, it's a remarkable place. And I think one of the things that you will experience is that Israel has sort of one foot in Europe and one foot in the Middle East. And you see that if you wander around Tel Aviv, you could think, that you're in a typical European city, but I think some, when you get to know the people and you see the culture, and it's a little bit, it's a little bit more chaos maybe than you would see in a place like Denmark, let's say. And so it's a fascinating counterpoint of a society that is both, I think, rooted in some European traditions, but also firmly planted in the Middle East. And, you know, I think one of the things, you also see that when you go to some of the gay clubs in Tel Aviv, where I know when we bring people to Israel, their favorite gay spot is a club called Arisa, which is the club mostly for gay Israelis who are, you know, or Moroccan or Iraqi, or, you know, just come from other parts of the Middle East, the Mizrahi or Sephardi Israelis, and they have better music, and so it's sort of an amazing time. I think people get to see this sort of the breadth of Israeli society and culture. But there's so much in Israel, I think, that is unexpected. And you know, it's a small country that sort of packs so much into this tiny spot in terms of what it does in industry and society, and most significantly, the way, in a very challenging place, it has moved forward in very important ways in the struggle for LGBT rights.
Yeah. One of the threads that's come up over and over again over the past 8 years of doing this show is that intersection between sexual orientation and faith. And I think we've done, you know, pretty darn well talking about various forms of Christianity and sexual orientation, and surprisingly have not really talked that much about Judaism and sexual orientation, which is, you know, a little ironic given that I'm the host of this show. What does it mean to you personally to work at that intersection?
So I think one of the things that I've looked for in my whole life are the places where I can be authentically my whole self.
Yeah.
Where I can be my Jewish self and my gay self, and really be present and be proud and celebrate everything that I am. And I think one of the things that at first surprised me actually was to discover that I could be that person in Israel, that there were many places in Israel where I could feel welcomed as completely who I am. And so I think for me that's important. But I also think there's something about the way that our LGBT identities span across so many other groups. And so for example, even as a Jew here in the United States, as part of mostly a Reform contemporary Jewish community, I didn't know a lot of people who were Orthodox Jews.
Yeah.
But now that I've been to Israel and have met the LGBT people who are building community inside of Israel's Orthodox Jewish community, I have so many friends in the Orthodox Jewish world. And I think when we bring our groups to Israel, the most LGBT people in this country, even if they know Jews, probably don't know so many Orthodox Jews.
Right.
So they're getting to meet people that they might never have met before. Or even on this last visit, I know I now have friends who are Ethiopian Israelis because they're also LGBT. And I didn't ever think in my life I would have people close to me in my life that were Ethiopian. But now I do. So I think there's something about this work that we're building bridges across so many different dimensions. And I'm getting the opportunity to get to know so many different kinds of people that might not have otherwise intersected with my life, that it's really quite rewarding.
Nice. And one of the opportunities that you have, I would assume, to meet all these people is through a wider bridge. There was a moment where you decided there's an organization that doesn't exist that needs to exist. Is that pretty much how this went?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think what happened for me is that I was seeing that in the LGBT community, even in the LGBT Jewish community, Israel was something that was, even if we talked about it at all, it was just as an argument.
Mm-hmm.
It had been the conversation about Israel had become so dominated by politics and the things that we might disagree about, that just this ability for us to get to know, and for Americans and Israelis to get to know each other as people and to learn about our common struggles and to see the things that we have in common had really been sort of pushed aside. And I felt that it was important for there to be a platform that would enable us to begin this sense of engagement. Let us learn as LGBT people what we have in common with people in Israel, what we can learn from their struggles, what they can learn from ours. You know, we as LGBT people, we're a tiny percentage of the population everywhere. And so I think I don't think it's helpful to our community for us to be isolated from each other. So I think I feel like the work of A Wider Bridge is helping to make the world a little smaller and bringing us together in a positive way and helping us, and by making the world smaller, helping make our communities stronger.
I love it. I love it. Well, let's talk about the values of the organization. I love deconstructing these different pieces of these really important organizations. We talked about Israel. Let's get at some of the other ones. Talk to our listeners about that value of engagement.
Sure. I think for us, I think we are about storytelling, about learning from each other's lives. And so you know, we lead trips to Israel where we bring North American LGBT leaders to come to Israel and see the country through an LGBT lens and meet the political leaders, the artistic leaders, the activists in Israel's LGBT community all over the country. And then during the year, we bring those folks to the U.S. to come here, to give them a platform to share their stories, for us to learn about each other's lives. I think it's in that moment when we tell each other our stories that the barriers between us really begin to break down. We get to know each other as people and appreciate each other's humanity and really see how much we have to learn from each other.
Yeah, absolutely. How about communal responsibility? I mean, that's such a core. I feel like in growing up and thinking about my own Judaism, that was just one of those values that my parents drilled into me from day one.
Yes, I think we are, you know, one of the values of Judaism is that we are all responsible for each other.
Yeah.
And for me, I guess knowing that there is a Jewish homeland, there's one place in the world that is called the Jewish homeland, I for sure want that place to be a good place for LGBT people.
Nice.
And so I feel a great responsibility to help support the work of the activists who are on the ground, who are doing the work every day to ensure that Israel is a place that I could call my home if I wanted to, and that can be a safe and a welcoming and a place where LGBT people's lives are celebrated.
Yeah. Now, you can't be a citizen of this world engaged in any social justice issues without knowing that this work, specifically the work that you're doing, comes with its challenges, comes with its controversy. How do you motivate through that adversity?
Yes, there is a lot of controversy around the topic of Israel. And I think for us, what is important is to, first of all, to see the people of Israel in their humanity, to realize how much we have in common with each other. And, you know, we had an incident in Chicago back in January that I think has, you know, got a lot of press, and
yeah,
we can talk about for a few minutes, where we brought two of the leaders of Jerusalem Open House, which is that city's flagship LGBT organization. We brought them to Chicago to Creating Change, which is the country's largest LGBT conference. And we brought them there with a specific purpose in mind, because the story they had to tell was of the stabbing and the murder that occurred last summer at Jerusalem's LGBT Pride March. And the work that this organization had to do to help their community heal and recover from that trauma and all of the, frankly, some really wonderful and inspiring work that they've done to strengthen their community since then. And so we thought that would be a really important story for LGBT leaders from around the U.S. to hear and to have some dialogue about. And instead, our program was effectively shut down by a large group of protesters who just felt that any conversation about Israel was not appropriate and needed to be shut down. And I think that idea is so damaging to our community. You know, I think that in the struggle for LGBT equality, I think so much of the progress that we have made as a community has been because we have been willing to sit down at the table with people who might not agree with us about everything,
yeah,
but to be able to share our stories and talk about our lives and gradually win people over. And so I think this idea that seems to be gaining currency these days, that if you disagree with someone, you don't give them the right to speak, I think it's really toxic for our community. I don't think it's in the long run going to help the struggle for LGBT equality. And so so as I move forward in this work, I think it's just about wanting to bring these stories to the table, wanting to create this sense of engagement and people learning from each other, and realizing that we're not going to agree about everything, but there's so much that we can gain from each other. And so I really think it's important to move forward, you know, with a sense of of dialogue and a desire for mutual understanding, and not with the sense that we want to somehow shut down the people who we disagree with.
Absolutely. Again, listeners, we're here with Arthur Slepian, the founder and executive director of A Wider Bridge. Talk to me about the importance of working with other organizations. It strikes me that that's pretty critical to doing the work that you're doing.
Sure. We work with countless organizations in Israel. We're partners with almost every major LGBT organization in Israel, even some pretty small ones too, in fact. And here in the U.S., we partner with Jewish organizations, with LGBT organizations. We've brought the leaders of many LGBT organizations to Israel. But when we do programs and we do events, we try to get as many local organizations involved in the work that we're doing as possible, because we want, we think there's so much that people can learn from each other. And so when we bring Israeli activists who work with teenagers in Israel to the U.S., they want to meet with groups like the Trevor Project and to learn from them. Or when we bring the leaders of the Agudah, that's Israel's major LGBT rights organization, they want to meet with folks like the Human Rights Campaign. And likewise, the Human Rights Campaign wants to meet with them. There's so much that all of our organizations can learn from each other. And I think the Israeli experience has a lot in common with the experience we've had in the U.S., but it's also been different in some key ways. And so I think that, once again, I think just making each other stronger by having these conversations and encouraging these kinds of collaborations.
So important. Now, I mentioned in the intro a new initiative, a U.S. tour with leaders of the Ethiopian Israeli LGBTQ community. How did this come about, Arthur?
So about 18 months ago, I was in Israel and met a young man who had just helped to start a new organization in Israel for LGBT Ethiopians. And I was so struck by his story and his courage and the work that he was doing, that as we got to learn more about it, we said these are voices that we want to support and that we want to bring to the U.S. And so we actually just completed that tour about a week ago. We brought these leaders to San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, and Washington, D.C., and they were so warmly received everywhere they went, and I think it was eye-opening for them, and it was eye-opening for the people who came to hear them speak.
Nice, nice. What are you hoping comes of this tour?
So I think to start with, they came with an idea of simply wanting to let people know that they exist.
Yeah.
To the sense of visibility. They are working with so many different challenges there. As Ethiopians in Israel, they have the challenge of some of the racism and discrimination that they face from the broader Israeli community. And then the second challenge, that they are not very well accepted inside of their own families and communities. The Ethiopian Israeli community is very conservative and traditional and religious, and so there isn't even a word in the Ethiopian language, in Amharic, for LGBT. So they've had a very difficult time explaining this issue to their parents. There's a sort of a sense that their families feel like they bring some shame to them and to their community, and so it's been a very difficult process. But I will say one of the things that I was really inspired by is that all of these folks said that they were so grateful to their parents and their grandparents for having had the courage to come from Ethiopia to Israel, where they had sort of dreamed for many decades to be able to live as Jews openly in the state of Israel, in the Jewish state. And I think for these folks, there was another layer of gratitude, because the ability that they have now in Israel to explore their LGBT identity and to live more complete, full, authentic lives as LGBT people is something that they would never have had the opportunity to experience had their family still been in Ethiopia, where being LGBT is a crime and the activists there have to be extraordinarily secretive and closeted, and really no one is able to lead an open life as an LGBT person.
Incredible, incredible work. I mean, when you're talking about a community where we have to start from the place of, hey, we're here, not even just the this is what we are about and this is what we would like to do and this is who we want to meet, but we have to start from the place of, gosh, do you guys know that we are an actual community out there? What an incredible place to start, Arthur.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these folks are all in their mid-20s, and they said they thought back to when they were 15 years old and how alone they felt and how they were sure that they were the only LGBT people in the Ethiopian community in Israel. And they wanted to not only to come out for themselves, but to start this organization and do this work so that the next generation of teenagers would not have that feeling, that they would know that they would have role models, that they would know that there was a possibility for them to lead full lives as LGBT people.
Nice. So this work is not without its challenge, Arthur, and we would be remiss if we did not hit on that really important thread of self-care. How do you maintain your passion? How do you keep from burning out in this very consuming work?
So, you know, I'm blessed to have a remarkable husband of 21 years, and who is just the anchor of support and love in my life, and surrounded by, you know, great many loving friends and family. And so there's a lot that I have to draw on. And I think, you know, there are days when this work is really difficult, because sometimes dealing with Israel is sort of like touching the third rail in the LGBT world,
right,
on the left. And so this does have its complications. But when I think about how much richer my life has become, how rewarding it has been, you know, to meet the kinds of people that we brought over this week from Kala, or to meet the many other LGBT activists from the Orthodox community, from the transgender community, you know, that I just feel really blessed. And so, you know, we have a great staff and we have a great board, and so it's just a matter of kind of getting up every day and doing the work. But there's no shortage of rewards in helping to do this. So you know, I feel like I'm doing a great deal to make the world better, but it also is sort of rebounding to me with a great many blessings.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful stuff. For all of our listeners out there, how can they get more involved in A Wider Bridge?
Well, they can start by going to awiderbridge.org. That is that's our website. It's our online magazine, and we have great content that changes every day. We call it a place that explores the intersection of LGBT, Jewish, and Israeli life. So that's the beginning. They can find all kinds of content there and all kinds of information about our programs. If people are in the Bay Area, we bring our programs here all the time. We have our second annual fundraiser coming up, which is a fun event. It's called A Wider Brunch on September 25th.
Nice.
But a great many things that will be happening in the interim. In June, we're bringing a really innovative modern dance troupe from Jerusalem to come perform here. In August, we'll be bringing a group of transgender teenagers from Israel to speak here in the Bay Area. So there'll be many different kinds of opportunities for people to participate and to learn more about us. And of course, we offer a trip to Israel where that might be right for some of the listeners who want to have a more in-depth experience.
Yeah. Does this count as my vetting for the 2016 LGBT leadership mission to Israel?
We would love to bring you to Israel. That would be a great joy. We should definitely talk about that.
Oh my gosh, my parents would be thrilled. They would be thrilled. Well, last question, and my favorite question always to ask to people who are doing this great work like you were doing. You mentioned your staff, you mentioned your board, and I'm sure tons of volunteers. I give you the platform, sir, to sing the praises of your staff, your volunteers, your board, who are engaged in this work with you.
Sure. You know, this can be difficult and challenging work, but we have people who are so committed to this vision, who really, you know, want to see the Israeli LGBT community grow and flourish and prosper. And we're so proud of the work that is being done in Israel, and they're so eager for these stories to be told here. We have people on our board from all over the country, from the Bay Area, Los Angeles, New York, D.C., even Canada. And we have a small staff. We have staff here in San Francisco, in Chicago, in New York, in Los Angeles. And it's a small group of people that work tirelessly to pull off the events that we have, but also to be out there every day talking with new people and developing continuing to grow the Wider Bridge community. So I'm so grateful that 6 years ago, this was an idea on a piece of paper that I had, and that to see that it has gotten so much traction and become, really, I think, an important force in the world for advancing the cause of LGBT equality and creating a deeper, more enriched understanding about Israel is really gratifying to me. And I'm so grateful to all of the people who have come to work at a Wider Bridge, or who have joined the board, who support our work as a volunteer or financially. I think we've built, I think, a really interesting community, and I look forward to seeing it flourish in the years ahead.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Everybody, you need to stroll on over to awiderbridge.org, awiderbridge.org. Listen, Arthur, any organization that is providing individuals with that place where they can express their full selves and connect with communities all across the world, this is the very definition of a mitzvah. When we're talking about engagement and pluralism and communal responsibility and justice, my gosh, justice, this is the work that needs to be done. And really, on behalf of just countless folks who are witnessing what you're doing and benefiting from the community that you and your staff and your volunteers and the board are creating, I thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, the Tony Award nominations were just released, and there's no one we would rather have with us to talk all about them and all things theater than our next guest. Adam Feldman reviews theater and cabaret for Time Out New York and has served as president of the New York Drama Critics Circle since 2005. He's also written for Theater World, Canada's Globe and Mail, and National Post, as well as for Time Out London, Broadway.com, Show Business Weekly, a ton others. In addition to reviewing, he has worked as an actor, an adapter, and a script reader. He's also one of the most entertaining social media-ers around. And now he is here with us. Adam, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, I will say this, Adam, we have a rule on our show. We've been doing this for 8 years now. Normally, we do not have someone on more than once a year. This is your second appearance in 10 months. This is a big deal for us.
Oh my gosh. I will try to live up to that pressure. I can't guarantee that I will.
We'll find
right
out.
Now. Can't guarantee.
We'll find out. Well, we need to start on a somber note. My condolences to you, Adam, on the discontinuation of Mostly Sondheim.
Yes, that is deeply saddening. And I should explain maybe to your listeners, not all of whom may know what Mostly Sondheim is.
Please.
What Mostly Sondheim was. So Mostly Sondheim was an open mic night at the Duplex in Greenwich Village in New York City. And every Friday night, people would gather in the upstairs cabaret room at the Duplex. And it was a hosted night, and there was a pianist, usually Brian Nash, who's a terrific pianist.
Yes.
And people would sing songs of their choice. The name was a misnomer from the beginning. It was never majoritarily Sondheim. But people could sing whatever they wanted, including pop songs, but tended towards musical theater. And it was a lovely sort of meet-and-greet space for people to try out new work and just get up and sing, and it formed what seemed for a while like a real community, and I'm very sorry to see it go.
But you're going to start a new night.
Someone will. I don't know if it'll be me. Someone will.
Okay.
And, they're still doing piano bar stuff at the Duplex every night, and there are other open mics around the city, and, we will soldier on. We will carry our torches. And we will burn them elsewhere.
I would like to remind listeners, it is the only place I've ever been fired from, but it's my favorite place to get fired from was the Duplex. Kind of proud of that.
I was fired from Footlight Records.
Wow.
Yeah, my first job in New York City. I lasted for 1 week, at Footlight Records in the East Village, which was the old destination for all the best cast albums and all the obscure Kinner Cabaret recordings. And I was terrible at my job. I was just terrible at
it. Wow. It's not for lack of dedication to that type of music.
Well, I was very dedicated to the music and not to selling it.
Okay.
That was the problem. I just wanted to spend all day looking through the inventory, and that's what I did. And it turned out that isn't what they wanted in an employee.
See, I don't feel so bad now. I got fired because I wasn't really that good of a singer, Adam. I just wasn't that good. It's just when you sing with Kate Pizakis all the time, it makes you feel much better than you actually are.
It's all good. It's all good.
Well, yeah. Well, Kate's doing fine for herself out west now. Everybody moves on.
Everybody moves on. And here we are. And here we are.
Here we are, soldiering on.
So let me ask you this. Let's take a step back. It is award season in the Broadway world. Do you get more excited for that? Or is it just like the rest of the year and it just happens to be some awards being given out at the same time?
Well, it's excited and exhausted would be an accurate summary.
Okay.
At least to begin. I mean, I do love awards. I'm one of those people who grew up really caring about this stuff. You know, I when I was a kid, I would watch the Tony Awards every year, and I would record them on my VHS, and I would rewatch those videos over and over until I had the musical numbers memorized. They were very important to me, and I've held on to that excitement about it. I think even to some extent now, even having covered theater professionally for 15 or more years, and having been through many Tony Award cycles, there is still something very exciting about it to me. And because it's a smaller community, it feels a little more personal than something like the Oscars or the Emmys do, because it is a smaller world that it's covering, and it's more. It's live and it's more personal, and the people are right there on the stage. You feel like you have a different relationship with the performers and with the writers. So it's still very exciting to me.
All right.
That said, there is such a glut of awards now at the end of the season. Not just the Tony Awards, but so many others. There's the Lucille Ortel Awards for Off-Broadway. There's the Drama Desk Awards. There's the Drama League Awards. There's the Theater World Awards. There's the New York Drama Critics Circle Awards. There's the Outer Critics Circle Awards. There's the Obie Awards. There's the Broadway.com Audience Favorite Awards. And so it becomes sort of hard to keep track of all of all of the prizes that are being given away. That said, it's nice for good work to be recognized, and there's a lot of good work, and there are a lot of prizes to go around, so that's nice.
This seems to be, I'm all the way in Cleveland this year. This is the farthest I've been from geographically from the Tony Awards in my entire life. It strikes me from all the way over here in Cleveland, it seems to all be about Hamilton.
Well, it is, to some extent. You know, Hamilton is a phenomenon the likes of which we have not seen in decades. So the wide expectation is that Hamilton will dominate in the musical categories. And that is almost certainly going to happen. The question is, to what extent will it dominate? It broke the record for the most nominations. It got 16 nominations, which is more than anyone has before. I think the last two... I think the producers in 2001 and Billy Elliot in 2009 got 15 nominations. Hamilton got 16 this year, but it can't win 16. It can win only a maximum of 13.
Okay. How many categories are there?
Well, there are 25 categories.
Okay.
13 for which Hamilton is eligible. It was nominated in every category for which it was eligible. So, you know, but it can't win in all those categories because it has multiple nominees in a couple of those categories. For Best Actor and for Best Featured Actor. So only one person probably will win. I mean, unless there's a tie, which would be hilarious. Unless there's a tie, the most it has a ceiling of 13 for how many it can win. I don't think it will win 13.
Okay.
The producers currently holds the record with 12 wins. I think that the weak area for Hamilton is Best Actress in a Musical, Best Lead Actress in a Musical. Phyllipa Sue is nominated, and she's terrific in Hamilton, but it is arguably a featured role, and it's certainly a smaller role than those of the four women against whom she's competing in that category, all of whom are also very good. This was a year, remember, in which Audra McDonald was not even nominated for her tremendous leading turn in Shuffle Along.
I didn't even know that was allowed to not nominate her.
Well, right. If I'm not mistaken, she has been eligible to be nominated 10 times in her Broadway career, and she has been nominated 8.
Yeah.
This is only the second time that she has not been nominated. And she's won six times out of those eight. So, you know, I guess the feeling probably was, given how crowded the year was, that she could afford to sit this one out. she's been hoarding Tonys long enough, and give someone else a shot. But I would be surprised if Pipisu won in that category, not because she isn't good in the show, she's very, very good in the show, but because I think Cynthia Erivo in The Color Purple, or Laura Benanti in She Loves Me, or Jesse Mueller in Waitress, you know, just have a stronger claim on the prize this year.
Yeah. This is very exciting stuff. I would assume, though, that this will boost perhaps the ratings for the telecast?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, look, Hamilton has been a phenomenon cross-culturally in ways that we haven't seen in a very long time. So people who are not interested in Broadway musicals at all are interested in Hamilton across various cultural groups, across various age groups, across geographical areas. As I told someone else recently, I was in Toronto a couple months back for a family event, and all my little first and second cousins, you know, my first cousins once removed, my cousin's kids, who are teenagers, they all were super into Hamilton. They all had an order of favorite songs. That's not something that I'm used to in youth culture.
Yeah.
That they care that much about a Broadway musical that's currently playing on Broadway. It's also been a huge success. The cast album has been a huge success commercially. There's enormous widespread cultural interest in Hamilton, and I hope that translates into better ratings and that the rising tide lifts all boats. But it is unfortunate for the shows that are up against it.
Right.
Because when you have a show that's this dominant, very few other shows have a chance to really to win anything. But they'll have a chance to put their wares out on the broadcast.
That's not a bad thing.
No, it's great.
Is it true, by the way, that we can't get tickets till like 2022 or something like that?
To Hamilton, no. I mean, it's sold out, I think, through next year. But there's, look, I mean, you can still get tickets. They're just crazily jacked up in their price because they've got this, without getting into details, they basically legalized scalping a few years ago. So there's this whole secondary ticket market that's sold through the primary ticket sellers. So if you go to, you know, Ticketmaster or whatever, you have this a whole side part of Ticketmaster that is devoted to commercial resale. And those prices are insane. I mean, the prices are already high for Hamilton because the demand is so high. And then they are jacked up, you know, 500% for resale. So you can find seats in the second balcony, you know, there's no second. You can find seats in the balcony for $1,500. But that's crazy.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's actually a lot.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. But, you know, this kind of demand happens pretty much never.
Right.
I mean, there have been huge ticket rushes in my day, and I've seen people scramble for tickets to things like The Book of Mormon and The Producers and Boy from Oz and Hugh Jackman on Broadway. But boy, this is unlike anything I've ever seen. And it's the first question that anyone ever asks me. Can you get me tickets to Hamilton? Have you seen Hamilton? How many times? It's all people want to hear about. And it's, you know, and that's great. I mean, but the thing is, what gets lost in that a little bit is that it's actually been a very strong year in many ways for theater across the board on Broadway.
Yeah.
There were 11 new musicals on Broadway this year and 5 major musical revivals, all of which were good. 4 of them, I thought, are extremely good. So, you know, in any year, like, you know, if you look back in time, there are strong years and there are weak years, and sometimes the Tony Awards are not always a great arbiter historically of what is actually the best, because some years are just stronger than others. It doesn't matter if you're Chicago when you're up against Chorus Line, because Chorus Line swept.
Right.
And it took, you know, Chicago did perfectly nicely for itself. It came back 20 years later, and it's, you know, that revival is still running. You know, so it's turned out to even have surpassed Chorus Line in its overall success. But at the time, it was overlooked. And same thing happens year after year. You get years like, you know, the year that Wicked was up against Avenue Q and Carolina Change, you know, and Boy from Oz. And then you get years where Memphis is not against anything.
Right.
You know?
Enough said on that one, yes.
That's how it goes, you know. You have your years where Contact will win Best Musical and Memphis will win Best Musical, and then you have years where Gypsy will not.
Right, right. Well, not that we relish in anything shade-worthy on our show. We do not embrace that side of this show is so gay, but I will say that perhaps you highlighted one of the more amazing tweets in the past week as you gave a shout-out and retweeted Jennifer Hudson's reaction.
Oh boy, yeah. Well, I just thought it was remarkable because people are usually quite guarded, Jennifer Hudson. I gather, I don't know anything about it, but it seems based on this tweet that her experience at Color Purple was not great. That must be very frustrating.
Yeah.
For a performer, especially a very talented one as Jennifer Hudson is. I love this revival of Color Purple, and I do somewhat agree with her that she was used more for her celebrity status and her name than she was for her talent, because I don't think her talent was especially well-suited to this part and this production. I saw it early in the run because it was in press preview. You know, I saw it in press previews, and I found that she was very good and sounded very good, and she was very competent, but that she lacked some of the sensual, natural qualities that this character, Shug Avery, is very much supposed to have. She's supposed to be incredibly sexually charismatic, and that was, I didn't feel like Hudson really was comfortable in her body in that way. My hope was that, you know, she would ease into that as the run continued, but I gather that she has not felt happy in it, and it must be frustrating when you're stuck in a role that isn't quite working for you. But she's leaving the show now, and Heather Headley is taking over, and Heather is an enormously talented performer.
Wonderful.
And I bet she's going to remake the part, and I'm very curious to see what she does with it.
My obsession with Heather Headley, it's pretty up there. It's pretty up there. I have to say this is about as, which would be saying a lot in 8 years, as gay as I will get on this show. The Dreamgirls live album with Audra McDonald and Heather Headley and Lilias White, I broke that CD. I listened to it so much. That was it.
Well, yeah, she's magnificent. And, you know, Color Purple, I don't know, Color Purple, I've said this before too, but I feel like it's very much the kind of show that the performer can make or break.
Okay.
Having seen it in the original production with LaShawn's and then with Fantasia Barrino, and then having seen it again here with Cynthia Erivo, very different shows, all of them.
Well, let's do a little bit of role play right now. You're Adam Feldman. We're going to transfer your employment from Time Out New York, and let's say that you're Adam Feldman and you are currently starring in Tuck Everlasting. Right? So you're in a musical that's...
Am I the little girl? Am I the 11-year-old girl?
I'm going to let you control
that. I'm hungry for life, but still inexperienced.
I love that this is now a resume builder and therapy for you. This is wonderful. This is wonderful. So you're starring in Tuck Everlasting in the part of your choice. Your production gets nominated once for costumes, but pretty much gets shut out of everything else. What does that mean for your production?
I think if I'm in the production, I probably would take it more personally because it will have commercial effects.
Yeah.
And I want to keep on working and... you know, so if it's all right with you, I would prefer to separate myself from the production.
Let's do it.
Because I think if you're in any show, you want it to do well, as well you should. And that's part of the problem, you know, with actors reading reviews. When you're in a show, you really just have to believe that it's great. You know, you can permit yourself later to reflect on it and say, oh, what a difficult show that turned out to be. But while you're in it, you kind of have to believe it. Even if it's, you know, one of the worst shows ever made. And Tuck certainly is not anywhere close to that. It's a perfectly, you know, likable family musical. But it's in a very tight year.
Yeah.
It has a lot of competition. And I don't know that there's anything that it didn't get nominated for that I would have nominated it for. I think it has a strong shot at Best Choreography for Casey Nicholaw's work in it. The most effective part of the show for me is this quite long and, for me, quite moving final ballet that he's put together for the show. That had a strong shot at getting nominated. Other than that, it didn't get snubbed, you know?
Yeah.
There wasn't anything that... people talk about snubs all the time, but really it's just that there are only five slots in these categories, and you can't nominate everyone. And in a year where there are 16 musicals with all of their casts competing for those, you know, for those 20 slots in performer category nominations, you're very lucky to get in at all. And I'm happy with some of them that did. You know, Jennifer Simard in Disaster, which was a show that was not a commercial success and which is closing this weekend, gave one of my very favorite performances of the year. And I'm thrilled that she has gotten a nomination. She won't win in the category for Best Featured Actress. It will almost certainly be Renee Elise Goldsberry for Hamilton,
yeah.
And that's fine. But I'm delighted that she got nominated.
Nice. Well, let's step away from Broadway for one second. All of my friends there in the New York City area, in the tri-state area, are all talking about Dear Evan Hansen. Is it that good?
Well, I reviewed it. I loved it. You know, I think it will be on Broadway soon. So it's currently in a limited run off Broadway at Second Stage. I'm fairly sure that it will be transferring to Broadway next season. There's already talk of that, and it got sensational reviews. It has sensational word of mouth, and it is blessed with a tremendously polished and moving central performance by a young actor named Ben Platt, who won the Clarence Derwent Award from Actors Equity just yesterday.
Wow.
Which is, I don't know if you know that award, but it is a within the industry, a very prestigious award for promising actors and actresses who are coming up. And if you look back at the history of who's won it, from George C. Scott to Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's a very impressive list. I happen to be on the voting committee for that award, but that's not why I'm touting it. It is actually just a sensational group of talent. Ben Platt absolutely belongs on that. He is a special performer, and he is the central role in this new musical by Pasek and Paul, the same team that brought us Dogfight and Christmas Story.
Yeah.
And this is a step up for them, I think, in sophistication. It is very well crafted lyrically, so it holds together very well. It formally is very nicely put together, and the music is in a pop idiom, but does so more successfully than a lot of musicals that try to. The pop sound that it creates sounds more recent than most pop sounds that pop musicals tend to go for. So I think all of that combines with a terrific cast, with a tremendous staging by, I said tremendous a lot in this interview, but with a tremendous staging by Michael Greif. It's very much in the mode of Next to Normal, which Greif also directed. It is a family musical, by which I mean a musical about a family, about two families, actually. It's a musical on dark themes with a troubled central character, and moments of lightness within that, and it's a funny show, it's a touching show. I think that it's not a big song and dance show, but if you like musical theater and you take it seriously as an art form, I think this is one that you're going to want to catch.
There you go. And very quickly, I heard tale that there are shows that are there in New York that don't have music, apparently things called plays.
Why would anyone do that?
I don't know. But some of them, I've heard, are pretty good. So for all of our listeners out there who are obsessed with American Horror Story, which I've never seen, but some people really love it, I hear that Jessica Lange in Long Day's Journey into Night, quite good.
Jessica Lange is sensational in Long Day's Journey into Night. And I say that as someone who went in slightly skeptical. Long Day's Journey into Night is a long play.
Yeah.
It is a long play's journey into night. It is almost 4 hours long. And when it is not good, that can be excruciating. This is very good, however. And so it all flies by. It is actually, you know, time is... it's a relative thing, you know. It is much easier to sit through 4 hours of engrossing, brilliant theater than to painfully claw your way through 70 minutes of crap.
Right.
And people think, yeah, well, shorter's easier. No, shorter's not easier. When shorter's bad, it's still painful. It's still more painful than three times as long. This is a wonderful obviously the play itself is an American dramatic masterwork, but that brings with it a lot of expectations and baggage. I think that Jessica Lange reinvents the part of Mary Tyrone, brings it to her strengths as Jessica Lange. She brings out all kinds of colors that I had not previously imagined in the part and pulls them off. She certainly plays Mary a lot more like how James Tyrone describes the young Mary in the second half of the play. She plays up the coyness, the coquettishness, the sexual need. She really does sort of suggest and can call to mind the life of this convent girl who had defied everyone to run away with a handsome actor years earlier. And she plays a morphine addict, and she the addiction is really front and center in the performance and in the production, both in her physical choices and also in the way that everything is about dodging and weaving and manipulating the people around her. It's, I thought, a magnetic performance, and I think that she'll probably get my vote for Best Actress this year.
Nice. See, we don't need music to enjoy something.
We certainly don't. And The Humans also is terrific and well worth seeing on Broadway. Just won the New York Drama Critics Circle Award yesterday. And Stephen Karam's new play, and very, very much worth seeing. And Eclipsed, also very deserving, and bringing a completely new story, new to me, to Broadway. So, yeah, a lot to celebrate this season.
A lot to celebrate. Well, to end, we are introducing a new segment onto this week's show called Bernie Sanders Watch 2016, starring Adam Feldman. Anything that you want to check in about there?
Well, no. I don't want people to hate me. I love Bernie Sanders, and I think he's run a great campaign. And then that's all.
Okay. That was remarkable restraint, and I commend you for that answer.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay.
I like restraints every once in a while.
There it is. Well, where can everyone go to follow all the cool things you, sir, are writing about?
You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, where my handle is Feldman Adam, which is like my name, except backward.
There you go.
Reversed. you can find my reviews and blogs and things like that on Time Out New York, the website.
There it is. Well, I have told you this before. I will tell you this again and again when we invite you back, because you are our theater reviewer. You have a turn of phrase that is so captivating. I'm serious. Simple as it is, I will say this so simply. I just enjoy reading your writing. You get to the heart of it, and you really frame it in such a witty and engaging way. And it's quite a gift, Adam Feldman.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for taking it, and thank you for having me on.
Listeners, go check out Adam Feldman. He will be starring in Tuck Everlasting coming up soon. Adam, always a pleasure.
Mine too.
You walked in the joint. I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind?
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we only have a few minutes left on this week's episode, so let me throw some of the LGBTQ news stories that have hit the wires this past week. Roy Moore, the notoriously anti-gay Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, is now facing ethics charges before the state's Court of the Judiciary over his attempts to block marriage equality. The Alabama Judicial Inquiry Commission sent the charges to the court this week, accusing Moore of violating judicial ethics by seeking to stop same-sex marriages from taking place in the state, even after a federal district court and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Alabama's ban on such marriages violated the U.S. Constitution. Roy Moore is suspended with pay from his position of Chief Justice until the court rules on the charges. If he is found guilty, he could lose his position on the court for a second time and possibly even permanently, although the Court of the Judiciary could impose a lesser punishment. That is the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, suspended. You can do these things, sir, but then there are consequences, and now Roy Moore seeing those consequences. Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton has offered to support a New York trans woman who was filmed the moment she was assaulted and called just horrible names in a busy subway car as onlookers didn't defend her. If you have not seen this video, gosh, I'm not even sure if I recommend it. I recommend it just so that you can see, holy cow, these things happen. But then on the other side, it is extraordinarily racist, extraordinarily homophobic. It's violent. It's not a video I would recommend seeing. But Hillary Clinton got in touch with the individual who was the victim of this verbal attack and really almost physical attack. Hillary Clinton wrote on this woman's Facebook page, quote, "I am so sorry that you experienced this. The all too high prevalence of violence and hatred faced by the transgender community today in 2016 is a rebuke to all of us. Every single person deserves to be safe and live free from discrimination and cruelty, period. And transgender people need to hear from every one of us that you are loved, respected, and deserving of equality under the law. Know that you have my support and I'm on your side." A very powerful statement from Hillary Clinton. We love seeing things like that. In our weekly North Carolina update, because it's just something new every week, North Carolina's officials are brushing off threats by the Department of Justice to withhold billions in federal education funding over the discriminatory House Bill 2, saying they're not making changes to the law before the Monday deadline imposed by the department. The department announced this week that the state's anti-LGBT law, which, just to remind you for the 8,000th time, bans all LGBT-specific non-discrimination ordinances and mandated which public facilities transgender people can use, conflicted with federal statutes that protect against sex discrimination in employment and public education. The federal agency gave state officials until Monday to redress discriminatory aspects of HB 2, such as forcing transgender students and public employees to use restrooms and locker rooms that conflict with their gender identity. While Republican House Speaker Tim Moore, a proud proponent of HB 2, was happy to publicly announce that he's defying the federal deadline. He said this, quote, "We will take no action by Monday. That deadline will come and go. We don't ever want to lose any money, but we're not going to get bullied by the Obama administration to take action prior to Monday's date. That's not how this works," end quote. More and more from North Carolina. The irony that all of these people's last names are Moore. There's that too, but I'm going to move past it to one happy story that we will end with for this week. A same-sex couple was crowned prom king and prom queen last month at a Florida high school. Lindsay Creel and Bree Grimes made local history by becoming the first same-sex couple to reign at Leon High School in Tallahassee. In an interview with the Tallahassee Democrat, the pair discussed how their newfound high school royalty is more than a personal win, but also a symbol of hope for other lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth. They said this, quote, "It feels good to know some of the things we've been part of can help others going through tough experiences in a positive way. I needed someone in my life to show me that it would work out when I was first going through this all these years ago, but I didn't have that." They added this, quote, "I hope that people will look at this and more will begin to think that it's okay to be supportive of the LGBTQ community. Leon often talks about change. This is a good example for younger students there." Congratulations to Lindsay Creel and Bree Grimes, who made local history in Florida by becoming the first same-sex couple to reign at Leon High School in Tallahassee, Florida. Love that story. It was shared tens and tens and tens of thousands of times, this story. So definitely making the wires. And that's all the time we have for this week's episode. Our huge, huge thanks to Arthur Slepian. He's doing such amazing work at A Wider Bridge. And of course, to Adam Feldman. Love his reviews of the theater. You guys, you know what to do. Get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?